And welcome to the Dice Are Screaming Podcast.
Yeah, that's right. The little gaming podcast that took no actual damage from reading a vacuous grimoire.
Ooh. It's true. It's true.
Best part of being a fighter.
Yeah, as Joe Don Baker likes to say, this whole thing rests on one element. Surprise.
Well, we've got that going for us at least.
Hey, I'm Randy.
I'm Mike.
And together we form the gestalt known as the Two-Headed Literary Podcast Literary Podcast known as the Dice Are Screaming. We'll get it right one of these days.
Yes, the Two-Headed Literary Etten of Gaming Podcasts is still one of our favorite call-in moments of all time.
Yeah.
That just, like, tugged at the heartstrings, sure did it not?
It did. It did indeed.
That was incredibly endearing.
Hey, yeah, we had a week off, a little bit of sickness and a little bit of overwork for everybody, but hey, we're back and we're glad you're with us. So
yeah, that was mostly sickness, and this one, yep, gotta own it, that was all me. Man, the middle of last week, I was in terrible shape. I've got the winds, something awful.
That's what they call it.
However, this was all purely non-COVIDian illness, so everything turned out just fine.
Right on. Yeah, we're back, and hey, we're, as promised, bringing you a review of RuneQuest, the Pegasus Plateau, and other stories, as well as talking about homebrew and how a lot of campaigns will benefit from having easy-to-play and ready-to-insert adventures, and that's what RuneQuest provided for us, the good folks at Chaosium. Got a nice review lined up for you here, as well as just our normal rambles and shenanigans. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. So we're just going to get right into it and jump right into our review. And we're just going to say right now there will be spoilers. So if you're planning on playing this or you want to run it, here's a podcast for you. If you are planning on playing on it, well, if you listen to this, there will be spoilers. So you will be running this for your game master, I guess. You only have yourself to blame. Go ahead and move on to the second part where we talk about our homebrew campaigns and sandbox.
Yeah, if you need to, go ahead and leap forward 30 minutes into the future.
Yes, you can do that. All right. So, yeah, this is a little bit of an older release, but hey, we're slowly catching up to some new stuff. This is one of the newer offerings for the role-playing and Glorantha.
And remember, per Glorantha's, textbooks, your Glorantha may vary. I love that about RuneQuest. They just very clearly, the people at Chaosium indicate that each game setting at each table is going to vary by a little bit. The way people accentuate this facet of the campaign setting could be different from table to table. The way the rules and various heritages are represented, the importance of religions and things like that, it all varies table to table, and that's okay. Very groovy people at Chaosium.
Yeah, and I like what they put right here on the front page. Have Mike read this for us.
You mean the intro poem?
Yeah, it has a nice little poem to start us off.
They answered in those woods, he might be sure, many and strange adventures would be found. But deeds there wrought were like the place obscure, and for the greater part not bruited round. They seek, they said, a worthier quest, secure. Your works will not be buried underground, so that the glorious act achieved as due, fame may your peril and your pain pursue. Orlando Furioso, that's Canto 4. But that in Roman numerals.
Yeah.
LVI by Ludovico Ariosto. What is LVI? I forget what the L is in Roman numerals.
Is that 50?
It might be.
Hmm.
No, I think it is. All right, so that would be 56. So Canto 4, 56 by Ludovico Ariosto.
Indeed, and as a good intro to that, I think it fits well because there are seven really well-prepared adventures for this. Two of them, the first one right in there, the Pegasus Plateau itself, is a very lengthy adventure with a lot of role-playing and in-depth setting lore. So if you're not playing in Clearwine Fort or the environs therein, which is pretty much the, well, I guess the new starter set we haven't reviewed yet, but we'll be getting around to that at some point here.
Oh, it'll happen. Although I'd like to take a moment out and invoke the Gelascopper before we launch fully into this.
Oh, yes. We must take a reading.
I'm going to need you to laugh. All right. The Gelascopper now reads your laugh and divines from the sound of your laughter the future. Ooh. Wow, that is a great future.
Oh.
Next week, the Rutger Hauer Power Hour, honoring one of our favorite actors.
Wow, all right. So the Rutger Hauer Power Hour, it is next week, so tune in for that.
Yeah, yeah. You can't swing a dead cat during the great age of science fiction and fantasy movies without whacking into a Rutger Hauer flick. And this guy totally deserves like a lengthy special dedicated just to one actor's contribution who has made so many movies and that we love.
Oh, yeah.
All right, now, launch.
Oh, yeah. So, the Pegasus Plateau, we're just going to launch through basically a overview on each one of these. The Pegasus Plateau is the first one, and it'll take the adventures from a holy festival in Sacred Games where the greatest prize is taming of a majestic hippogriff.
Yeah, and one of the terrific features here is that the players are not necessarily in direct combative hostile opposition, but they have rivals. They have people who they're striving to achieve more than. But it does not have to break down into open combat. There will be some of that later, but with other things. But the idea of being in competition, that rivalry is not a thing that necessarily ends in death and mayhem. It's a nice feature.
Yeah, and this one also features a lot of non-combative competition with games, the typical stuff with wrestling and throwing, and also testing the mettle of your characters through dance and also traditional songs. But it also pits the players against other members, including a member of the Lunar Empire who comes trying to seek a visit or a chance to gain one of these hippogriffs for their own means. And that's can be a recurring NPC if you have one. Definitely, I would make it out a Lunar Empire that the players have particularly vexed them in the past. Show up for this one, or can replace the NPCs, or you can just develop it out of this character. It's a pretty fun adventure, although a little lengthy, and it features one of the people you have to get past is a Rune Lord of the Sun God. that's something to be aware of. And also, the character's runes are going to factor in this one. Each one of the hippogriffs is attuned to a particular rune. Now, yeah, most of them have air runes, so mostly your worshippers of Orlanth and other sky gods are going to factor in heavily here to gain one of the more powerful and useful ones, but there's other hippogriffs that are attuned to other runes.
I feel like we skipped over an important detail. Oh. What is the importance of the hippogriffs?
The marriage between the sky god and the earth.
And this contest, this event, the hippogriffs as a mount are the prize.
Yes.
Yeah. That is the nature, like that's the stakes, okay? That's the bait. Yeah.
Those who pass the tests will be proclaimed worthy and greeted by the priestess of Rinalda of the Emerald Temple.
Yeah, that is not a small prize in RuneQuest, okay, to have a hippogriff as a mount. So just throwing it out there, like right out of the
Yeah, this is not merely just taming the beast, but it's attuning yourself. They do not take well to being forcefully owned.
Yeah.
And their appearance has been is a great foretelling of many of the myths of the age in which, as the Three Wind Celebrations, as it's called, as the Three Emeralds Temple, which is one of the near Clearwine Fort. And of course, the Wind Games, as they're called, have different aspects to each part of the Three Winds religions of Orlan. And so the rival seekers here are all given various stats and also more importantly, personalities, why they want to be here. So working against some of the player characters, some of them may be less than scrupulous in trying to get a mount for themselves.
Now, there we come to the crux of it, which is, while most of them are honorable enough and are brave and are trying to prove themselves as worthy as any of the player characters might wish to, and hey, you know, some of the player characters may not wish to pursue a Pegasus mount.
Or Hippogriff.
Sorry, a Hippogriff mount. Oh, my bad. I was just remembering Pegasus Plateau there. But some of your rivals may not be scrupulous in their undertakings. Whether this devolves into combat or not is really, you know, where the PC and the PCs and DM choose to go with this.
Right, as the Rune Lord of the Sun God shows up, he is there to test the player's mettle to see if they are indeed worthy. Jandrin, the Sun Lord. Sun Lord of Yelm. And he's well represented in a nice picture there. And then the next adventure is a smaller one, but nonetheless important, called the Lokeum, which basically fills a alternate starting place of in the near Sartar area of the tribes near Yamelios in the Lunar Empire. And this one sets up a conflict, as all of them do, in many of the clans, and is the formation of a new episode in a campaign. So if you're looking for an alternate starting place with new player characters, this is the place to go. And that's followed by the Grey Crane, which is another little bit lengthier adventure, but the Grey Crane is the third adventure provided here. And this one sets up that there is a relic, the regalia of the Grey Crane, which has gone presumably missing. And the players are nominally of the tribe, but you can also insert your players here.
Yeah, this is a whodunit, you know, a get it back / whodunit classic MacGuffin. And it provides in the RuneQuest world, it gives the players that terrific, almost, the feel I got from it was kind of the Black Bird. You know, it's that wonderful unraveling mystery, you know, with complete with yanking the mask off the head. Captain Lammers. No, I'm kidding. The point is that this is that mystery hunt that is going to involve player characters asking questions and trying to resolve a scenario that cannot be solved merely by violence. You know, applicable amounts of brain power may be required for this adventure. Yeah, and I love that.
And not only during the time that the players are investigating the disappearance, they find out that the regalia of the Grey Crane has a mind of its own, and it is tired of being just an heirloom hung at the clan hall and wants new bearers. So the players may find themselves indeed entrusted with this at the end if they play their cards right. But also, a little fly in the ointment is the involvement of a lunar procession from the moon and a noble who has come wanting to see it for himself. All that entails, finding out, of course, that two Lunar Empire men did, from his encampment, end up stealing it on a drunken binge, although much encouraged by the cloak to go for an adventure in one of its places of great strife in the past, a sorcerer named Miskander, who has been bound between life and death here.
And that takes you to Miskander's Tower, which, ooh, wonderful haunted ruin, you know, kind of atmosphere. That's much more in your classic dungeoneering, you know, the haunted tower.
Indeed. So this one will provide some overland travel, but not too much, and also a lot of role play with the clan and with the Lyceum and the Hendricki people as well. So you might want to bone up on that before running this, but you can also insert this in other places where you feel appropriate. The next one up is the Rattling Wing. It's one of my favorites. It was also offered as a free download. More or less honoring Greg Stafford's view of how to get to know people and go outside your comfort levels. The Rattling Wind deals with a hamlet of Barfield, and apparently there has been some goings-on, a haunted village, as you find it, a little hamlet, that has a deep mystery in it. And, of course, having to go to Barfield and get to know its inhabitants uncovers a murder long ago of a lunar rune lord. His spirit has now returned in his chariot and seeks vengeance on those who slew him dishonorably in his sleep.
Ooh.
Yep, and during this time, you're going to have to get the aid of some ducks. Yep, that's right.
I'm letting you have it.
Yep.
Everybody already knows how I feel about the whole ducks and RuneQuest thing. I'm not gonna belabor that, man.
Right, and if the players will confront the Rattling Wind, which is a spectral chariot with its fiery rune lord at the head, they can be able to best it. And of course, if they find out the mystery and means of his murder, they have the tools to put him in rest once and for all, with the rewards being several items and things of his from the past that the villagers have kept.
Oh yeah, and that's a nice stuff, by the way. I'm just gonna throw that out there. That is not it's not necessarily a small reward.
Right, but in the finest traditions of RuneQuest, it is a mystery that needs to be solved. That is, again, conducted without violence. But yeah, there is a lot of violence. Spoiler alert, you're gonna have to fight a ghostly rune lord.
Yeah, this one, you may not resolve this simply by fighting him. That is a component of it. But you're not going to get through this one completely unscathed.
They dumped his chariot in the lake, and now the ducks reside there. They're well aware of it, but since things have been frosty between the duck enclave and the villagers at Farfield, it'll take some mending of fences and some diplomacy to get both sides to come together to get the truth of the matter. All right, and then moving to the next one, which is the Crimson Petals. This is more of yet another little mystery, and that seems to be a prevalent with this one, but also it's a little bit more direct, as you are going to have to use the relations from one of the player characters, or just insert an NPC that gets the players to go to the Greyrock clan, mostly a village of herders and farmers. And it's about 250 inhabitants, but somebody has been murdered. And it's coming to terms with that and getting the area around it during the great winter and overcoming some of the problems. It's going to again take role playing as well as magic and the powers that come from the worship of various cults and the areas around them. So lifting the curse is of course something that will become apparent during the investigation, and you must read the village from both the curse and the consequences of its murder. And then another one of my favorites is Gloom Willow's Hollow, and this one's a darker one, which you have to go into the Haunted Forest, the realm of the Ghoul King, Brainbane, and his monstrous kind.
Yeah, and this sounds about as spooky and challenging as it really is. Okay, that's, if you're looking for something that is a little more directly threatening, you know, little less of the extreme hidden mystery, like we got to spend all this time asking questions. Okay, some question asking is probably a hot idea in any adventure, but yeah, this one, nice challenge level.
Yeah, this is a lot more direct and forward, where the others were kind of mysteries, murders, and things of the past coming back to haunt you. This one is, well, yeah, it has a haunting to it, but this is a bunch of ghouls running amok, and it's one of the more dangerous players areas that player characters can find themselves in.
Yeah, so this I would recommend only for more experienced Glorantha citizens, okay? Those who have had some time under their belt and have acquired some rune mastery and are fairly, you know, they are strong in their art and mighty of thew. Okay, yeah, this is an adventure appropriate for those.
You know, one of the highlights is a fight with a ghoul pack, and if you manage to kill over a dozen of them, the ghoul pack of over 30, the leader comes out, salutes you, and runs off.
Yeah.
So if you stand your ground, normally the idea would be to run away with them pursuing and fighting a running battle through the haunted woods, which is exciting in its own right. But if the players decide to just hunker down and show what they have, and they give it in good measure, they can survive this.
Yeah, in the haunted wood, it's much harder to find yourself. Like, we move to the highest ground and then, like, secure ourselves. But they may have to, you know, scramble inside the wood to find a place where they have some kind of territorial advantage. You know, some degree of partial cover or improvised, you know, way to reduce the number of foes that would otherwise surround and mob them. So yeah, decidedly challenging. This one tests your tacticals.
Yep, and
I love that stuff too.
Oh yeah, this is good. And then we go down to the last three, which is Ruin in the Stream, which describes an ancient and forgotten place, but also provides a chance to learn from one of the most enigmatic teachers, and some esoteric cult lore to be had here, as well as some opportunities for some powerful items and spells if the players are willing to be patient enough and best the challenges put before them. So this one's more of a magical based game, with a lot of the players' abilities being tested indirectly, as well as the players' patience and knowledge.
Damn.
I didn't know there was going to be this much talking.
Yeah, man. Wait a minute. You look, I'm back in school.
Yep. And then the other one, which is kind of a pun for Steve Perrin, which is called the Pairing Stones, takes the adventures to the Plains of Prax, which you should know well in your Glorantian lore. This is an old and venerated place full of lore. And they must intervene when a wedding between two scions of two tribes goes horribly awry. And trying to mend fences and get everything back to the way it should and mend broken relationships will test players' diplomacy, as well as their deductive reasonings, rather than their sword skills in this one, although there are several duels that could result from this, and the consequences of however you resolve this will, just like with the Grey Crane, will resonate through a campaign. So this is one where, again, you're going to have to look, know your players and know your campaign and how you play this out. That'll bring us to the last one, which is Renekton's Hope, which is a locale-based adventure with a mix of opportunities and problems. But it is a place for solace in an area rife with war and violence. It is a healing place at the end, and if the players can gain the trust of these folk, they can find a place to mend their wounds and solve some of their sorrows, which is unique in Glorantha, that these are things that wear at the characters constantly in a land filled with turmoil, war, and constant strife between two great empires. But that'll bring us to our end. That is a quick review. That'll put us at the Seven Adventures. And of course, as we were looking at this before, your Glorantha may vary. I'm just going to read here that mantra is used frequently when discussing great staff in the world of Glorantha. The setting has seen many significant tonal shifts, details have changed, the dates have shifted around, spellings have been altered, and in some cases, major aspects of the world have been altered based on an evolving view of the world and the increased range of voices contributing. The writers for this adventure collection were specifically recruited to emphasize the diversity and approaches to the world of Glorantha, with voices reaching all the way back to RuneQuest's first edition to creators who've never written for RuneQuest or Glorantha before. As such, these adventures reflect that wide range of styles and approaches to Glorantha, RuneQuest, and gaming styles in general. Hopefully, these adventures demonstrate to new game masters and players alike that there is no single way to play RuneQuest or to experience Glorantha, no sole voice or approach that should be held above all others. While reading through this collection of stories, it is important to keep that in mind and to recall the other great axiom of Glorantha and those who go there. We are all us. So that will conclude our little review. We hope you enjoyed it. We made it short and sweet, but we're going to keep reviewing products right at the first part of the show and then launch into our other part of the episode. So, what were my impressions of this is that it's easy to weave these into an existing campaign, but with a little skill, you can use all these adventures in a single campaign. But if you just wanted to use one right after the other, you need some space in between to let your players adventure and grow.
I'm going to say with almost all Chaosium products for RuneQuest, there is enough variety that any game master worth their salt can pick and choose. And if you're running a lengthy enough campaign in RuneQuest, obviously you can inject, you know, handmade material or encounters slash conflicts slash adventures. But if that's not to your taste, the people at Chaosium have provided amazing anthologies of potential adventure that you can mix and match from, where you can, hey, okay, this is from this particular book, and then our next encounter will be from some other book, and then the next encounter will be like a campaign arc for a major source book, and then I will interject once again and come back to Pegasus Plateau and other adventures for an item that I really liked. There is so much that you can customize and borrow from, and or, as so often the case, just be inspired by.
Right.
There is no shortage of that stuff in the RuneQuest world. So, Glorantha, I can't say enough good things about the people at Chaosium. I mean, they are just hyper-literate and really good writers. They've really got a wonderful sense of what makes a fun game.
Well, from Roland Furious, I mean, right there.
Oh, Orlando Furious.
Orlando, but yeah, Roland. Our good friend. Up here of the realm. And yeah, there's so much to add to this in Bronze Age fantasy adventure gaming, and how that your clan, your reputation, your honor all play a factor into this. Because if you have high honor going into this, some of these adventures are going to be easier than others. But honor has its drawbacks. A very high honor score character must behave in very scrupulous ways. In a misstep, a careless word, or ill-tempered action can ruin your honor.
You know, I feel like we mentioned that in our original, you know, intro to RuneQuest thing, but I may not have gotten as much attention as we should have mentioned, because it is a major facet of gameplay that I think, you know, reputation, you may have noticed the way they score your reputation in video games these days,
yeah.
That like the rep you have has an enormous impact on your ability to interact with other people, both economically and individually. Their forthcomingness with information, the cost of their goods and services are impacted by your rep. Now, here's Glorantha, where that's been a major facet since the beginning. The honor system, where like you've gained glory and fame through your brave and noble deeds, but it's fleeting. You can lose it. You know, the pressure is on. People expect you to behave like a great hero. You better behave like a great hero.
Hey, you can find yourself in the outs real quick.
Yeah, suddenly deciding that like, hey, I may be a great hero here, but today I feel like being a jerk. One day as a jerk can undo a year's worth of like hard work to be a great hero. People's disappointment in you does count for something, so there are risks attached. But like with so many RuneQuest products, it's ideal for the creative who wants to interject written material into a pre-existing structure of stuff of their own. Some people don't want to use a rigid major campaign source book and run a game that like it's a very narrowly set series of events. They want to do a little more free-flowing. We'll see what happens, where the players decide to go. And if they're doing that open sandbox kind of thing, products like Pegasus Plateau are great aids, where you can just insert a little pre-written material without disrupting the flow of what you were trying to achieve.
Yeah, and letting you have a little night off as a game master by not having to design a whole new adventure. Which will bring us to our next point, which is that good old sandbox campaigns always need a little help now and then. So we're going to get into that, but first we're going to take a little break, so hopefully you stick around and join us for our next portion of our episode. Back, so thanks for sticking around. Hope you enjoyed that review of Pegasus Plateau. It was a lot of fun too. But right now we're going to get into the main affair. But remember, the Arcane Eye is always out there getting stronger.
Yes, we have no Arcane Eye today. The saving throw has been made, but it will return. Of that you can be certain. It's never truly gone. Now,
so yeah, this comes from one of our listeners. This is a listener supported radio here. WPGU. Yeah, so
at WWTF.
WWTF is morbid. Right. So one of our longtime listeners, first time callers now. He just Radio Joe on our old Facebook site, which you can always access through that old Facebook. Dang old Facebook.
Yeah, vintage creature that it is.
But yeah, they wanted us to talk about homebrew settings. So here we are. So with the man of the hour, Mr. Hannah, going to talk to us about his homebrew or how to start specifically. And I'm going to give my views on how to do homebrew. And you know, we're going to kind of blend it in with the sandbox ideas.
Yeah, I think everybody has tried their hand as a gamer scheming up something that is a momentary setting of their own. But I never really, you know, for many, many years, I had nothing cohesive or coherent. It seemed like way too much effort to craft an entire campaign from scratch. Didn't really occur to me. But a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. I think it was like 1994, 95, and I was just getting into Magic the Gathering. And so, like, the actual moment of, like, the first tidbits were being conceived, you know, I thought, hey, what a wonderfully creative game. And the cards have, like, these locations and, like, the colors, the mana, and, like, major themes of play pit these different nations against one another. Like, the color white has, like, these, you know, pure knights and these clerics and, you know, country of good, you know, standing steadfast against, obviously, you know, like, the color black, which, you know, got demons and
what?
All kinds of horrible creatures, the undead, skeletons and zombies, necromancers and all of that. And, you know,
Cabal ghouls.
You know, and green has got your forests and giant spiders. Anyhow, the very archetypal themes of that appealed to me. And I had just jotted down some notes, but you've got to come up with your own kind of things. You know, I mean, there hardly seemed any point to me in using ideas that had already been done. So in that creative sense, I was only creating things that I thought might be like a nifty idea to transplant into Magic, like just to home make some cards, just to put a spin on it and see how it worked. So I started developing nations that they would come from that had those corresponding aspects. For instance, the blue was going to be, you know, Gorican pirates. And the white would be Imperial clerics or Imperial paladin. Now, that was the formative moment, but it occurred to me a little further down the line. About 3 or 4 years later, I looked at those notes and I thought, hey, you know, you got some interesting notions there. And another thing had happened since then. I'd read Isaac Asimov's Chronology of the World, which was lent to me by my brother initially, and like I've maintained a copy ever since. Isaac Asimov's Chronology of the World is a enormous spanning historical text. It is a chronology of the events that transpired since the creation of the universe into and up to about the, right, it ends right about the events of closing World War II and the, like, formation of the United Nations and things like that. It, you know, like, we start to consider that the modern or postmodern world. And when you read a text that breaks it down in a really nice way, that also highlights moments of invention and like the rise of technology, and also at certain points, the ebb of technology, you know, when the knowing of things gets lost because of internecine conflict. So you have this enormous history spanning thing, and that had a huge impact on the way I thought about campaign structure. So when I started drafting these notes again, I was like, no, these shouldn't be magic cards. These are perfectly valid places. Why not, you know, reshape this into something more like a campaign setting? You know, wouldn't that make a nice campaign setting? And so the scrivening and the note-taking, at that point, knowing what I know about, like, actual campaign settings, like, oh, well, we're going to need us some gods. We're going to need us some various faiths. We're going to need some other locales. We've got to fill this out. And I used, like, a vintage globe as a kind of planetary template.
Mm-hmm.
And the areas that I selected to place the greatest emphasis on were the continent per se of Europe, divided in one particular area by mountains, the Caucasus mountain range, of course, which is quite famous. Right. So, you know, it's what makes it so hard to launch a, you know, winter fight in, you know, in Russia, in, you know, over the centuries. But
and war in Asia.
I had kind of flipped the core concept for nations, though. Mm. I had a large imperial presence on the eastern side and a much more sparsely populated and undeveloped region on the western side. The eastern side of the mountains had the grand old empire of the East that had unified five different nations and come together, and they were sort of the starting off point where peoples had broken away and started to small cause other smaller countries in every direction as tributaries or as outlying provinces, but that eventually broke away and became their own entity. Of course, this was only possible because of the immense distance that imperial forces would then have to travel to then reassume control.
Uh-huh. So did you give your campaign world a name before or after?
Oh, much after.
Much after? Okay.
The nickname I had for it was Legendary Realms, because it was an homage to, like, I love the Forgotten Realms and I love the work of Ed Greenwood. Mm-hmm. And I wanted a little touch of that. The fact that I loved RuneQuest led me to do a couple of things as well. When I was getting that final shape of it into place, I went to a silver standard for coinage,
mm-hmm.
With silver being the most common, you know, larger, wealthy coin used rather than gold. Gold is that deals between major trading houses and nobles, deal in gold.
Yeah, I mean, just to take a little segue for a moment, take a rabbit trail off this. I mean, one of the big complaints I have about, no, I don't have any real big complaints about early D&D, but after playing it for a number of years, you start to realize that gold is kind of a bad standard to have because it's pretty rare. And yeah, you can just constantly, as a DM, just insert gold wherever you want to. But and if gold was that available, man, Middle Ages would have been a lot different place. But yeah, I mean, the silver does make a sense, and it preserves the rarity and value of gold as mainly a noble's coin or one of kingdoms and merchants.
Oh, yeah, it increases the luster. I also made it a low magic campaign.
Mm.
Not in the, like, truest sense, where, like, there is no easily accessible magic of any kind. No, I went with a medium low, where the setting was designed to release more magic into play as the level of challenge increased. The players, one of the perks of adventuring and traveling to deserted ruins in haunted forests or, you know, hideous swamps that are full of creatures that, you know, have not yet been tamed by civilization.
Right.
The whole point was that this is where the relics of the past are, the high age of magic, when powerful sorcerers were still at work and you know, items of terrifying power were created. All that's left now are these little tidbits. You're like, oh, well, you know, we've got a sword that's been passed down in the family for several hundred years and retains its edge and never needs to be polished.
Magic.
You know, that's great, but it meant that those things are extremely rare and of ridiculously high value. You can't buy them in shops. You know, you have to go out. If you want these wonderful things that make you more dangerous and more powerful, you got to go get them. Mm-hmm. So it increases the bait level for, you know, like, hey, why bother? You know, the place has only got a few little plus one little items in it. I don't even know why I'd bother to go there. Hey, when the value of those suddenly shifts gears to like 10 times their like DM guide listing value owed to rarity, then all of a sudden, hey, there might be a few relics of the dwarves in that place. Oh my gosh. And that was another facet of the campaign. The I hid away the elves and the dwarves. All that was left was half-elves and half-orcs. The halflings and the gnomes had split off. The halflings retreating to an enclave with the elves, and the gnomes to an enclave with the dwarves. And they had fled from humanity after conflict with the Empire. You know, the same old ancient argument, resource and spaces. And rather than engage in warfare between like an enormous population of humans that continually replenishes and a small population of demi-humans that slowly replenishes, they picked the route of, you know, we're retreating into our enclaves, hiding ourselves from humanity and having nothing to do with them. And so now a facet of gameplay is also the player characters going into these mysterious and faraway places and eventually discovering that there are still elves and dwarves in the world. But new challenge, you know, next challenge unlocked, convince them to re-engage. What honorable quest will be necessary to convince them that humanity is worthy of dealing with again after such a terrible conflict hundreds of years ago?
Right. So it basically sets the stage for more human-centric campaign without as many options. So obviously, it's not one of the things that you start with they think is really important to emphasize is when you start making a new campaign, you have to have a prehistory. Now, I'm going to offer a secondary view. How I started my first campaign years and years ago was basically a friend of mine had really pushed me not to use Greyhawk. Forgotten Realms really wasn't around back then. It was just Greyhawk. And I had heard about the Judges Guild Wilderness campaign, and I was kind of curious about it, but you know, being younger, I didn't have as much disposable income, and you know, those things required, you know, sending a check in the mail, which meaning having to have a checking account. What?
Yeah, you know,
adulthood. What? Get out of here with that.
Yeah,
well, I'll do that when I'm older, like when I'm 22. Yeah, okay. So anyway, so getting back to. So, yeah, I didn't have it. So he just said, hey, you know what? You got a good imagination. Why don't you try it yourself? So I went with some advice at the time, which was don't design too big. So I was using the core D&D principle. So there was going to be no real rule changes. I basically started with a hex map. And I borrowed a city because we were all just stealing and reading good stuff from different sources. I used the Pandathway, the Sleeping Dragon.
Although a little classic.
Yeah, as our starting city. Put it on the coast and then start branching out. As we use some published adventures and some different things, I was letting other people ruin our campaign. We had a kind of a Eastern flavored city, Shangzhou or something like that, coastal city that another guy wrote up on. And so that got put on there. So it became sort of a hodgepodge after a while with the Great Marshes and from the, Ghost Tower, Inverness was in there, and goodness, I'm trying to remember, White Plume Mountain.
Good setting, please.
Right, and I just kind of stole those, the Great Rift and places like that. So they showed up in the campaign world, inexplicably, just because, you know, we ran the module and that was a place we went. So we developed it as we played, which is an interesting concept, but the core values of D&D, killing things, taking their stuff were obviously there, but the gold standard, I didn't have to really come up with a whole lot with that one, and the gods were pretty much culled from the same way that Ed Greenwood did. I had some of the Uko from the Finnish mythos, as well as some of the Olympian pantheon, but not all of them, like just Apollo and Hecate as the goddess of magic. And it slowly developed a kind of thing of its own, but like all things, when you play in high school, you kind of like look back at it with the cringe level. Oh, it's my first character I ever developed, that half demon, half angel, half dragon. Oh, don't look at him. I don't want to
three halves.
Oh, my first character. Oh, it's, it's always awkward. No, my first character was a dwarf, so not awkward at all. But yeah, I can. You look at your
I'm
first
so game. Ashamed. My first one was an illusionist. Unarmed and mostly harmless.
So basically what I was doing was not so much creating a campaign, but a place to play a sandbox adventure. And that's a direct opposition of how you started. You started up with a great history. You know, my history was basically like, well, read parts of the DM's guide, and that's what happened. There's a Vecna guy, because that's cool, because it's metal as hell.
Yeah, Vecna! And Koss!
Yeah, and, there's a...
Like, literally, the blistering guitar riffs should kick off right, every time you mention them. There's not enough meatly me's for Koss.
And the teeth of Delvinar, what the heck's up with that thing? Yeah, the teeth.
Well, the next phase of adaption, right before it got vested into being a playable campaign setting, I had been playing Forgotten Realms in Lansing solo with a coworker because he was the only other gamer I knew there. We ran the Forgotten Realms campaign for about a year. All the while, I was adjusting the campaign setting that I was developing, the so-called Legendary Realms, which, is a working title. I also suddenly ran into a book by Dave Duncan, which I have mentioned in the past, The Reluctant Swordsman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a guy who is a chemical engineer who winds up in a an Iron Age barbarian world where, weird magical things seem to happen at the goddess's behest, and he is supposed to be a master swordsman to serve the goddess. But why was he brought here? To do the goddess's will and be her champion and defeat the evil sorcerers who have, totally invaded and, taken a long stretch of the river and are standing in direct opposition. They're killing swordsmen and taking over towns. So why pick a chemical engineer who was dying from a mosquito bite on Earth and make him this guy? Well, giant spoiler. The point is, in this 3-book series, he's a chemical engineer and he understands technology, the sciences. And the sorcerers, as he unveils in the 2nd book, they may seem terrifying and mysterious and all-powerful, but the real thing is, they're scholars. All of it is technology. It's not sorcery. They don't read lips. They have, long-range telescopes, in an Iron Age society. They have spent centuries cultivating technology, but keeping it to themselves. And then dressing it up as magic. They wear their bulky robes, and in a culture that doesn't have these technologies, they can pull off tricks, communicate with one another, create light in a dark room with the mixing of a couple of powders, conjure fire with a sulfur match, and most specific, they have developed gunpowder, which is why the tide has suddenly shifted and they dare to come out in the open instead of being slaughtered by swordsmen wherever they're found because of some ancient conflict. Now they have the upper hand and they're using simple grape shot cannons and flintlock pistols. But I had been reading Chronology of History by Isaac Asimov, and it occurred to me that the technological ebb and flow of history was very uneven at points. And I wanted to do something like, well, what if we had an end of the Iron Age, beginning of the Age of Steel time setting? And steel was available, but it was the most expensive elite weaponry out there. And one particular country set in the center of those mountains that divide the old empire from the little new fledgling lands. That mountain kingdom had sealed itself off at an opportune moment and used its immense wealth from like processed iron ore that had become, you know, malleable and been made into steel. They used those profits to, you know, secure themselves a little neutral Switzerland-like status where everybody wants our steel. You come and pay, and we've got the best weapons and the best armor. So, like, we just parcel out what people are willing to pay high prices for. But off to the south was a nation led by a priesthood that, and nobody has ever conquered this country, you know, like in centuries. And what's been happening is that their priesthood has refused to divulge the, you know, discreetly inherited secrets of technology that they have worked on year after year. It's the province of their leadership, their culture. These like monks devote their lives to study, to, you know, the powers of the mind, and to the advancement of technology for the benefit of their people. But they must keep it secret. They dress it up like magic, just as in Dave Duncan's books.
Right.
And I decided that that would be a nation in the campaign that they were unconquered. And they, like, if you can think of a location more like North Africa, you know, a mixture of North African, Malian, and Egyptian history, like the Songhai Empire.
Yeah.
But if you imagine them having their Renaissance level tech, the early flintlock pistol and other things like that, and imagine them not using it for instantaneous advantage, but retaining it as a defensive advantage, that white people deal with us on our terms because they know that, you know, the last time somebody attempted an annexation or invasion, like, we had the army out in the field, but in front of the army was a little row of, you know, priest monks with, like, no actual spell powers. But they're wearing the robes, and they look mysterious and dangerous. and the enemy army charges. And then all of a sudden, a series of small grapeshot cannons are fired into their front ranks. And men and horses are annihilated, you know. There's a large amount of smoke, and nobody knows what that means. You know, this nation pronounces that, like, well, we conjured demons of fire to destroy our foes. Well, you know, in a pre-industrial world, people believed that and went, all right, just don't screw with them. Dude, never mind. We're not going to invade. We're just going to turn around and go home.
So as I understand, this awesome. Became a class.
Yeah. I had to narrow it down to one. And I created a monk ambassador, that this was one of their priestly class who was permitted to travel the world and, you know, pay attention to the technology of other places and see what was happening. Their first loyalty was to their home nation, but they had access to limited amounts of technology while they were out in the field. And they wore robes that disguised their actions. They fought as monks with simple weapons. They had certain rules regarding, you know, what their conduct would permit and what their alignment could be. No evil, because, you know, they're expected to act responsibly with the secrets that they're entrusted. But you would have then a person who fought mostly as a monk and had some of the mental discipline powers familiar to monk-type classes, the extreme resistance to charm, the, you know, advantage on saving throws against mind control, the ability to, well, in their case, instead of reading minds, it was more like they could exercise hypnosis. They had learned the arts of hypnotizing people, and it worked a little bit like a very simple charm spell. If you recall, in the around the 1.5 era, there was a mechanic for hypnosis.
Yeah.
So I went ahead and harvested that. But at the same time as they're growing in levels, they're permitted to carry more and more useful gadgetry, up to and including difficult to make acids. Greek fire, yep. And eventually at high enough level, a firearm of their very own, tucked in a robe sleeve. But yeah, the whole campaign was built, and then I started to think of places to put in tropes and tricks and classic movie material that I loved, based on loosely familiar, like for the Greek Aegean setting, we had the Isles of Leptos. For the rowdy coastal area, we had the nation of Corica, with its, you know, almost piratical sailors. Rather than traditional Vikings, there was a land-bound mountain kingdom in the distant north, where the north folk lived in their fastnesses and made it through the winter by the thinnest of margins, but were insanely tough and hardy. So wherever you went, I'd spiced things up. Oh, there was a desert kingdom by the name of Fahar, where, you know, copious wine and olive oil from the coastlines could be gotten in the areas that were nice, but, you know, out into the trackless desert, much harder to survive. But fabulous tombs of an ancient age were to be found.
Wow.
But yeah, that was the point. All the tropes that I could think of, everything that would allow me to inject something from a favorite movie or from a favorite book, I tried to make spaces that were appropriate for those, much like you did, where, like, how can I get this Greyhawk item I really love? Hey, let's make a place for it in the campaign. Except that I codified everything.
Yeah, I didn't know what the Greek river was back then. Hey, you know, it sounds like a pretty cool place.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah. It's a big place. And so, yeah, when you start out with a campaign, our advice would be, you can go as detailed as you want, and of course, that's going to lead you in different directions. You know, you have to be flexible, and you also have to be able to incorporate new ideas. And in Mike's case, like you said, you had places, movies, and books, and themes that you wanted to put in there. You also had various other types of areas that you could explore that would be more familiar to D&D players.
Yeah, I started off, you know, with just a random idea about an adjusted magic card.
Sure, and so they can lead you in weird places. You know, I incorporated some Michael Moorcock on the Bedasker and Tainorn in there, but that was just basically because I thought they were really cool ideas. But yeah, no matter how you do a homebrew campaign, you're always going to have a lot of work ahead of you, and sometimes the way to make shortcuts is to borrow stuff, but it's definitely well rewarding and it's worth doing. However, you know, it does have its drawbacks. And one of the things that we discussed earlier with the Pegasus Plateau is that having those kind of one-offs or inserts of other material can really help flesh out your campaign, as well as make a sandbox campaign a lot more interesting.
Oh, yeah. I harvested tons of classic material from modules to inject into the campaign while mostly using handwritten material, which is why anthologies like that are such a vital asset to inspire and help DMs everywhere.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us. That'll cover the topic. Hopefully we answered your question. If not, you can, and if you want us to cover something further or something we left out, let us know. You can download that dang old Anchor app and, of course, favorite us as your podcast, and let us know on our Facebook page, as well as leave a message for us, and we'll play it here on the show. But other than that, I think that's going to do it for us. So we'll see you next time. Until then,
may the dice always roll in your favor.
We're out.
See ya.